And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, Kate Torrey, Andy Clements, James Lewis, M.B. Van Dorn, Eric Messner, Karen Carbone, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, Peter Stray, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 32, Circle Thrice. Previously in Deathlands. The companions were intent on making a hasty jump back to Deathlands after their turbulent stay in the seismic remnants of old Japan.
Where are we going to put the Grins?
They've only got 20-second timers, haven't they? Not all that long.
Right. We don't really know how long it takes for a jump to be properly initiated. Feels like 30 seconds or so before we become unconscious. Might be a deal more than that before we actually get to jump out of there.
The Grins could go off while we're in mid-jump? Is that what you're saying, John?
Right, love. Could put them in the elevator shaft when we're down there. Seal it off tight and also bring the house down on top of everything.
That would bury us snugger than a pharaoh in his sarcophagus, would it not?
Sure would.
Something malfunctioned with the mechanism? What then? Then it'll be a long goodbye and a big sleep for us all, as Mr. Chandler would have said.
Ryan didn't know who this Chandler guy was, but Doc had a point. It would be kind of like sawing off a branch that you were sitting on.
Mashashiga won't be invading Deathlands, nor will any of his men, nor his brother.
But there'll always be someone else who will find the house and the gateway.
Yeah. It was tempting to take the Grins with them back to Deathlands, where they could always find a use. But Christy was right. Everything that they'd seen in what remained of Japan pointed toward lethal problems over the next few years. There was an obvious risk to themselves, but a greater risk for the future if they didn't act now.
Use them in the house. Last burner and an implode. Last pair of implodes can go up in the elevator at the final moment before we go to make the jump. We can check that everything seems all right in the gateway first.
Nobody argued. When they stood in front of the elevator, Ryan almost expected Dean to appear and eagerly ask whether he could press the controls, as he always used to. During the time in Japan, Ryan had put his son to the back of his mind. Now that they were heading home again, he wondered how the boy was getting on up in his Colorado school. But Ryan set that aside and reached for the keypad himself.
JB, use your burner in the implode. Jack, keep yours for the last minute. Set them for the full 20, and then get in quick.
JB set the timer on the scarlet and blue implode and lobbed it out through the interior door into the hallway, following it immediately with the burner.
Please stand clear of the doors.
If it quakes now, we're in deep shit.
Ryan was looking at his chron, counting down the seconds. As they were entering the Matran's control area, the tiny digits flickered around to 20. Ryan noticed even at a cursory glance that the control area had suffered from the recent quakes, with some consoles dark and several ceiling lights off. One thing that had been worrying him was how they would actually jump to Deathlands, whether the ordinary last destination button code would do the trick. But he noticed something they'd missed on the way out. There was a sheet of paper taped to the door by the control panel with a list of American regions on it.
Want me to do the last grands?
Sure. Do it now. Christy, we could copy this list, take it with us, and see if it operates from other gateways. Give us control over where we want to jump to.
I fear, my dear friend, that it would be fruitless. The codes differ from redoubt to redoubt. I remember that from my time with the White Coats. Just pick a place and enter it.
Send him up in the elevator. Got about 15. Closed out a door. Get protection. But should go quick.
Right. Ryan scanned the list. How about Tennessee? Haven't been there for a while.
Do it, lover. I got a bad feeling that something's going wrong.
The Grins?
Not time yet. Coming up now.
In!
Code set. Ryan stepped in and grabbed the door. Everyone knew what to do. JB took off his fedora and placed it on his lap, then carefully folded his glasses and placed them safely in a pocket. The Uzi was in his lap as well, and the scattergun was within reach. He held Mildred's hand. She reached out for Doc, who was sitting next to her, laying the ebony swordstick at his side, stretching out his aged knee boots. Jack, his red eyes swollen from crying, sat next to Doc, pressing his skinny back against the armor glass wall. Ryan finally seated himself alongside Christy, having unslung the rifle, placing it by his side.
Here we go.
Sayonara, my friends.
The discs in floor and ceiling were beginning to glow brightly, and the familiar white mist was gathering above their heads. Ryan felt his brain being scooped out of his skull and whirled around and around.
Tennessee.
His last sensation was one of pleasure, knowing that they would soon be home again. Then, the quake hit. The Matrans units were highly sophisticated pieces of equipment, the finest that the white coat scientists of the pre-dark times could design and manufacture. In the last year or so before Skydark, the government had been working on a number of ultra-secret projects. The Totality concept was the blanket name for all the differing branches of research. Within that Pentagon-controlled umbrella, there was Operation Kronos, dealing with time travel, the Genesis Project, which dealt with genetic tampering and DNA research, and Over Project Whisper, which had a number of arcane, mysterious, and murderous subdivisions. One of these was Cerberus, which covered the installation of matter transfer gateways in a number of specially built military complexes called redoubts. The Greens and liberals and conservationists at the end of the 20th century had been enraged at the way the government had chosen to site these redoubts, riding roughshod over all objections. Many of the redoubts were located in idyllic and isolated parts of the country, remote from cities. In many cases, the deep buried complexes had been located in national parks. In the apocalypse that followed the Skydark megacull, some of these redoubts had been destroyed. But others, abandoned, had been maintained by superbly engineered nuke power plants that kept the gateways functioning. Ryan and his friends had stumbled on one of these long-hidden redoubts and accidentally triggered the Matrans unit, finding that they had miraculously jumped to somewhere else. Since then, they'd made a number of such jumps, generally with safety and success, but not always. The big problem was that all scientific data had gone with the missiles, and nobody knew the codes that enabled the users to choose a specific location. All Ryan knew was that when you shut the door of the hexagonal armaglass chamber, you triggered the jump mechanism, became unconscious, and woke up some other place. That was what was supposed to happen. But the timing of the devastating earthquake and the Japanese redoubt proved crucial to the jump. The dissolution of the molecular structure of each of the six companions took place, but the reassembly was abruptly interrupted. The reception unit in Tennessee was on alert, the initial mechanism functioning, but there was nothing to receive. The microcomps searched the void, making tens of millions of calculations every second, seeking the physical parameters for the six humans in order to try to complete the assembly and conclude the jump. Ryan Cotter, male, late 30s, 74 inches, 205 pounds, left eye missing, right eye pale blue, skin dark, hair curly and black. Multiple scars all over his body, including one that ran from eye to the corner of the mouth on the right side of the face. A myriad list of endless details covered every aspect and measurement of Ryan, from the length of his stubble to the condition of his fingernails. It went on to describe the clothes that Ryan Cotter had been wearing. The long coat and the white silk scarf weighted at the end with silver dollars, blue denim shirt, dark blue pants, combat boots. The computers searched for comparisons, weights, and calibers for his weapons. The Steyr SSG-70 fired a 7.62mm round and was mounted with a laser image enhancer and starlight nightscope. A Sig Sauer automatic was holstered on his hip, the P226 model, carrying 15 rounds of 9mm full metal jacket rounds. Length was 7.72 inches. Barrel length was 4.41 inches. Its weight, 25.52 ounces. An 18-inch Panga was sheathed on the other hip. There were similar details for the other five friends, concentrating on the unusual elements that made them the individuals that they were. John Barrymore Dix, male, similar age to Ryan, 68 inches tall and 140 pounds soaking wet, hair thin and dark brown, complexion sallow, eyes brown, lean build, wire-rimmed spectacles. Clothes included jacket and pants with endlessly capacious pockets filled with all manner of miniature tools, picklocks, wrist cron, and microsextant. The computer also noted his beloved fedora hat. He had two guns, the M4000 Smith & Wesson 12-gauge scatter gun with a folding butt, pistol grip, and its unique ammo, 8 rounds of Remington Flechettes. 20 of the lethal inch-long darts were in each shell. His Uzi automatic machine pistol held 20 rounds of 9mm ammo. Christy Roth, female, mid-20s, 71 inches and 150 pounds, green-eyed, with fresh complexion, well-built, long red hair. Nearly a century after the new cost, there was still residual genetic damage throughout Deathlands that led to all manner of mutations in animal and vegetable life. The computers were thrown by Christy Roth's fiery hair, puzzled by its sentience. In times of stress, her hair would seem to shrink and curl closer to her skull, almost like a cap. When things were going well, it would flow luxuriantly across her shoulders. The system reproduced precisely what she'd been wearing. White shirt, blue pants, jacket, Western-style boots made of blue leather. Her weapon was a Smith & Wesson double-action Model 640, 5-shot 38 caliber, with a stubby 2-inch barrel. The unseen mutations that were an integral part of Christie's persona were also duplicated. Her strange gift of seeing a threat of danger, or feeling when there was any life force in the immediate area. The Matran system had some problems with Jack Lauren. Male, late teens, only 64 inches tall, and barely tipping the scales at 110 pounds, deep facial scars, hair of purest white, eyes of ruby red, full-blown albino, very athletic build. He wore a leather and canvas camouflage coat over a ragged fur jacket, denim pants, and combat boots. His weapon was a satin-finished Colt Python Magnum, 357 caliber, 6-round, 6-inch barrel, a man-stopper, a cannon of a gun for the skinny albino teenager. He also carried a number of leaf-shaped throwing knives with heavy taped hilts concealed all about his person. Mildred Winonia Wyeth, female, age indeterminate, either late 30s or 120. The computer found that aspect of Mildred difficult to handle. It had no way of knowing that she had been born in Lincoln, Nebraska, on December 17, 1964. A doctor and expert on the medical freezing of human beings, she had gone into the hospital for minor abdominal surgery a few days before Skydark on December 28, 2000. Things had gone badly wrong. And ironically, to save her life, it had been necessary to freeze her cryonically. She had been plucked back from eternal sleep by Ryan and the others. Her skin was black, her hair black, in beaded plaits, height 64 inches, weight 140 pounds, eyes brown. She wore a quilted denim jacket, reinforced military jeans, and calf-length boots of black leather. Mildred's weapon was typical of the woman and her unusual skills. In the last ever Olympic Games, held in Atlanta in 1996, she had won the silver medal for the free-shooting pistol event. She had scored 398 from 400 and was arguably the finest shot in Deathlands. She carried a Czechoslovakian target revolver, the ZKR 551. It held six 38 caliber rounds. The beautiful gun had a solid frame side rod ejector and short fall thumb cocking hammer. With it, Mildred could put all six rounds into a 3-inch target at 50 yards. The last of the six was Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, whose genetic makeup was so unusual it completely freaked out the computer. Most of Doc's Matrans facts were simple and reasonably straightforward. Male, height of 75 inches and weight of around 150 pounds. Hair, grizzled and shoulder length. Eyes, pale blue. Face, deeply lined. Oddly perfect teeth. The clothes weren't a problem. Old-fashioned frock coat, faded and stained coppery green with age. Cracked knee boots, white denim shirt. And the weapons weren't common, but they could be found in the infinite database of the Matrans system. Doc carried a reproduction of a famous handgun from the early days of the Civil War, the Jeb Stuart commemorative Lamah, engraved and inlaid with gold. Peculiar for a pistol, the Lamah had two barrels. One fired a single round of 18-gauge grapeshot. A quick adjustment of the hammer accessed nine 44 caliber rounds on the cap and ball system. The other weapon that Doc always carried was a long ebony sword stick with a silver lion's head hilt. The black wooden cane concealed a rapier of superb quality Toledo steel that bore the engraved message, Nomi sake sin razón, nomi invaines sin honor. Do not draw me without good reason, and do not sheathe me without honor. It was Doc's age that the powerful computer found difficult to process. Doc's actual birth date was February 14, 1868, which made him something like 230 years old. He had married pretty little Emily Chandler on June 17, 1891. They had two children, Rachel, who was 3 years old, and Julian, who was just one when their father completely vanished. Operation Kronos had been working in ultra-secret conditions to try to achieve time travel with a view toward utilizing it against the Russians. Retroactively assassinating Joseph Stalin was just one of the aims of the project. Sadly, the Whitecoats could never get it right. They began by trying to trawl people from the past. Judge Crater was one of their spectacular failures. The writer Ambrose Bierce was another. They disappeared from their pasts, but what emerged in the secret laboratories in Virginia bore scant relationship to anything human. Their successes could be counted on the fingers of one hand, and the prize of them all was the eminent scientist and philosopher, Dr. Theophilus Tanner, one of the leading academics of the Victorian era. They dragged him forward to 1998, where he proved so difficult and uncooperative a study that they were glad to get rid of him by pushing him forward again in December of 2000. The scientists who had destroyed his life died themselves days later in the nightmare of Skydark, and Doc found himself stranded in the heart of Deathlands, nearly 100 years in the future. For reasons that nobody could understand, this man, who was only in his mid-30s, resembled a man in his 60s. The experiences had also taken their toll on his mind. Doc wasn't always in absolute control, but then no one was in control when consigning the body's particles to the Matrans process. But eventually, all the physical elements were resolved, and the process of reassembling the six humans in the redoubt in Tennessee began.